I don't know why dust, when we talk about anatta. The thing is, it's not, it's 2 weeks time, in 2 weeks now I'll be talking again here. No, beginning of next month, and he wants me to talk about anatta. So can you ask dust or not?
No.
Whether the next topic, yeah. The topic for the next talk I'm doing here on the, what's it, beginning of September, is it going to be on anatta again?
I can ask.
Because anatta means no self. Okay, anyway, you talk with Taz. I might talk to him later. Now, as you know, actually this title, you got to be adjusted a little bit. It's not because of Buddhism that there's no lack of self. It's because there's no lack of self, therefore there's the Buddha was teaching. Can you get the point on it? Because that's the nature of things. In our Buddhist way of teaching, there are three things which we consider to be very important. That is what we call the universal characteristic. To put in very simple term, when you exist, all these three things will be there. You cannot escape from it. Number one is anicca, which is impermanence. The second one is anatta, which is translated variously as non-self, no-self, no essence, and all these things. And the third one is dukkha, suffering. Right? So wherever you go, all these three will be present as long as you are there. When you are dead, maybe all these things doesn't matter. Right? When we are alive, you got to face with anicca, you got to face with anatta, and you got to face dukkha. It's the three characteristics of existence. Right? Now, it's very easy for me to explain anicca or impermanence, isn't it? You all know that. Everything in this world is impermanent. As the Buddha says, all conditioned things are impermanent. Impermanence means it changes, keep on changing. You can see some of the changes, you can see very clearly. Some of the changes you don't see very clearly. For example, the clear changes you can see in morning, the sun comes up, then it gets cold and it gets warm again, the sun will be there. And then after that, comes the evening, comes the night. It's 24 hours, there's always change. Now, again, you can look at the sky, sometimes there's clouds there, sometimes there are no clouds there. You can't simply say that I'm going to have cloudless day all the time, neither can you say I'm going to have a cloudy day all the time. So, we all have a very good understanding of anicca. But unfortunately for a lot of people, they still think that there's something which is permanent. We think that maybe there are certain things like, you know, the table is permanent. It's like that. But the table is not permanent. It looks at the table now, come back in about 1,000 years time, the table is gone. It'll be something else. So there's nothing in this world which is permanent. That's why it's said in our teachings, all conditioned things are impermanent, subjected to impermanence. We're subjected to all these changes. The second thing is a bit more difficult to explain. That is this anatta or no self. It's usually translated as no self. No self meaning that there is no essence. A lot of people think that no self means things don't exist. It's not true. Now, that's why I said in the beginning, it's quite a difficult thing to explain anatta. Because all the time since the day you were born, you were being given all the information about the self. You see, when you are born, there's no such thing as self. You don't even know what it is. Right? When you're hungry, you yell out, you eat. If you don't get food, you yell some more. So, but now, when you're hungry, what happens? With the self, we start to think. So, the thing according to how you are being conditioned over the years. So now when you're hungry, the first thing to come is, I want to eat. When you were a baby, when you're newly born, when you're hungry, it's just a feeling. A nice feeling that there's nothing in my stomach, so I yell. But now when you're hungry, you don't yell, do you? What do you do when you're hungry? look for food. Okay, you look for food because that sensation itself brings out that conditioning. When you're young, whoever brings you up, mother, father, or auntie, or whatever, say, when they're hungry, call me, I'll give you food. Then when they say, oh, I'm hungry, they're giving them the food. Then when you're a bit older, when you're hungry, go to the kitchen and get the food. Even when you're coming to uni and you live on your own, when you're hungry, you get the money, you can buy the food. You don't yell. So in other words, that sensation brings out the action. And then the action is caused by what is in your mind, how you're trained. So when you're hungry, what do? Right? Okay, you want food. Then you start to think, I want to eat this thing, or the thing, or the thing. So you're piling all these ideas into yourself. Right? And that ideas is the one which brings out this self. Because it's your habit will reflect yourself. Right? Now, when you say, I want to eat nothing but rice, and if I want this rice, I must have this thing and this thing. Or another day you say, I must have pizza. I want my pizza to have this topping and that topping. So it reflects on your thinking. And that comes from all the years of conditioning. I know a lot of Asians come from Southeast Asia, they eat nothing but rice. Every meal must be rice. One day they don't have rice, they feel the suffering. So it becomes, there is their character. It becomes their habit. And that habit constitute to the self. Now, we don't only have one habit just of eating. We got so many other habits. You can think for yourself how many habits you have. Do you eat with your right hand or your left hand? When you go to the toilet, do you squat down or do you sit down? So these are the sort, this sort of things, it brings yourself into a sort of identification. Maybe the way you talk. Some people talk with their hands moving. Some people talk, and then you feel very dull, very boring. That is also a self. You contribute onto it. Now, that's why when we say this self, it is to do with the I, my, and mine. When you say self, I am there. This is my habit. And whatever I do is the mind behavior. Right? So this is this mind there. And it's the mind that contributes to what we call the self. It doesn't mean that you don't exist. According to the Buddhist teaching, you exist as a human being. That's about all. The bottom line is very simple. You are a human being. But on top of the human being, we pile a lot of qualities on it. Now, how we behave, then what do people think of you? The most important is, what do you think of yourself and how do you project yourself? So, like, for example, you take an ordinary person, he's a person, he looks like that, but his behavior depends very much on his conditioning from the very young days. What is expected of him? And then what he thinks that others expect of him. Then from there, there's all this, he becomes to be identified as a person. Right? Say for example, like, look at me. Now, there are five of you have five different opinions of me, right? You could ask your friend, ask and see. You might agree on some of them, but you won't agree on all of them. No. You look at me, okay. He's Asian. He might be from somewhere from his accent. I know he's from Southeast Asia. Maybe he's an Indonesian, maybe he's a Malaysian, maybe he's a Singaporean, isn't it? Then you look again, he should be about between 60 to 80 years old. Then you start to, you bring that sort of image into you. And what actually you are contributing is your version of myself. Isn't it? You're trying to identify me. And from the identification, you're putting into that. Okay, he's that, he's that. Then, of course, there are many things which will come, the inference which comes from that. When you see somebody, then you start to have perceptions. When you get more ideas than the person have shown, then you start to say, maybe, is he married? Or how many grandchildren have he got? Does he drive a big car? Or does he drive a small car? Does he live here or there? See, all those things. And you're putting slowly, one by one, you're making that self of that person bigger. Right? But for me, now I say five of you have five different opinions. In this room, there will be six opinions of me. Right? Because I have my own opinion of me as well. Right? And that opinion of me contributes to myself, what I think of me. That means it gives me the essence, no? What is all these things? Now, for me, I know what I am, supposedly. But sometimes, if I'm not careful, I try to project myself differently from what I am. I want to impress on you that I'm such a good Dharma teacher. So when I want to impress you what a good Dharma teacher I am, what shall I do? If I speak normally, you say, it's just ordinary thing, isn't it? So I must project myself Dharma teacher. I use a lot of Pali words. I talk in a very Pali words you don't understand. Then they say, he's a very, very profound teacher because you don't understand me. Therefore, you think that I'm a good teacher, isn't it? So, if I can project myself that way, suited to your way of thinking, then I become a good teacher. Then you call me, and say, Jim coming to talk. Oh, yeah, very good teacher. You tell people, Jim is a very good teacher. But you ask you what's so good about him, maybe you don't know, isn't it? Maybe you say, maybe he talks things that you won't own up that when I say things you don't understand, you consider me to be good. So we have, or maybe something, sometimes I want to impress people by dressing up nicely, right? Put on expensive clothing and think, let you think that I'm earning $200,000 or $300,000 a year. Right? Or maybe I might go and do some hair transplant, put on a wig, and then just go for all this cosmetic surgery and impress you that I'm 35 years old. So these are the sort of things we contribute to, that kind of thing, the self. And usually when you have that sort of attitude towards self, we always end up in one thing. It's called dukkha, suffering. Because when I try to impress you, then I suffer. Because when I try to impress you, if you fail to be impressed, I suffer. If you are impressed, I got to think of more things to impress you, then I suffer. Right? So these are the sort of things. Look at this, all these three. They come together. Hope they have gone home. Okay, if everybody come in already, so I think they must have gone.
They all practice.
Yeah, working very hard.
Should start
on
next time. Because no point.
They can't come here.
They can't come.
Never mind, don't worry. Okay. We'll just talk a little bit. Because I'll be talking almost the same thing in 3 weeks' time.
Then they come.
I'll be talking about Diamond Sutra.
Pastor, he's going
to
change the topic.
Huh? No. He says, that I'll refer to a Diamond Sutra. He wants to bring some Mahayana into our teachings. All the time we teach Theravada Buddhism. Now we are going to talk about Mahayana, right? So I'll be bringing my Chinese Mahayana books here. Okay, now forget what I said just now. Now we start again.
Buddhism.
You know, Buddhism is only religion who talks about lack of self. You realize that, no? Every other religion in the world, you look at it, Hinduism, Christianity, Islam, even the Baha'is, they talk about that thing called a soul, you know. It means we all have got a soul. To them, they've got, since they got a God who is a big self, therefore you are the small self. Now, they believe that human beings are part of that big self, part of that God. So you are here, and then because you are here, you'll be there, exposed to a lot of trials and tribulations, suffering in this world, and therefore you must obey the commandments of the big self. Right? So the religion is work on that. Whereas in Buddhism, we work in a very, very different way. You can say that the Buddha is the only one who taught non-self, because we do not have much, the historical Buddha did not talk very much about the soul. In fact, he talked something against the soul. Right? There's no such thing as that particular one inside here and then comes out and do something and then go back again. Then when he dies, he suffers. Right? I mean, in Chinese Buddhism, there's a bit of this sort of things, but in the Buddhism as taught by the Buddha, there's no such thing. What the Buddha talked about is that we are a continuous process in this world. When you exist in this world, it's from one thing which leads to another, which leads to another. Right? You look into life, we can prove it this way. From the time you are born, because of the conditioning, every time you are conditioned, you change. Then you change, and because you are also a biological being, you also change because of the biological change. So the mental and biological change keeps on going, and therefore you are now. Compare what you were when you were born, the little baby. Or maybe 2 or 3 years later, the young child is learning how to walk. Are you the same or not? Are you different or not? That's why the Buddha says, at no time can you identify a person as it, what it is. It's only momentarily that you can say it is there. But the moment you think that it is there, it is no longer there. It's changed into another thing because of the changes. And that is why the Buddha maintained the teachings of non-self. Right? At any time you can say, now you can say, I see Jim. But the moment you think that you saw Jim, Jim is changed into a different person already. Both physically and mentally. Although we cannot perceive the change. We do not see the change. Short moments, we usually don't see. But if you don't see me for another 10 more years, if I'm still alive, I'll be there with a walking stick and then say, is that Jim I saw 10 years ago or not? We are different people. But is that the same person? You can see it's the same person. Otherwise, who is this Jim I saw 10 years ago? Now, that is the problem with our arguments. We cannot say that it's Jim, we cannot say that it's not Jim. And therefore, we say that Jim you know has got no essence. So, it can be yes, it can be no, and you cannot pinpoint at any time that is a particular person. Other people of other religions, they cannot see through that sort of things. But Buddha did see through these sort of things. That is this problem there for us. Most of human beings cannot see that change. Most of human beings cannot understand the change. And unfortunately, most of the human beings cannot accept the change. And because they cannot see the change, they cannot understand the change, they cannot accept the change, therefore there is suffering. Now, supposing we are so used to good things, I'm so used to be, when I was 19 years old, I looked much more better than all of you. So, if I want to maintain my looks at 19 years old, if I'm what I am now, I look in the mirror, I'll be very unhappy, I can tell you that. So, that is the thing. If you want to stick on to the things, and in the Buddhist way of looking at it, if you want to get stuck to that self, the idea of self, you are going to get suffering. That is definite. And that's why for most of us, we say, or nearly all of us, we say, if we cannot understand impermanence, if you want to have a permanent self, therefore, we'll suffer. So, in Theravada Buddhism, it's taught this way, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. impermanence, non-self, and suffering. Now, we got to come back somewhere. If we say, if there's this idea of, we carry this idea of non-self a bit too far and say that, no, you don't exist, or all your own, your existence is my imagination, like what I said just now, right? All of you will think of me differently. Then you're going to get problem of identity, isn't it? If you just see, oh, he's a human being, he's a man, and let's finish off with it, then how do you identify me? How do you identify Jim? So firstly, we got to put a name to the person, we got to see what the person is and so on, right? And then we put something which is relative to us, right? His position, his age, and so on. So we establish the identity. But if we are not careful, we make the identity into that person's self, then we have got problem with that person as well. If you identify me as a very, very good teacher, very good man, a holy man, and so on, you are going to get problem later on. When you see me smoking, or you see me going to the pub, or you see me driving very fast, right? Or see me getting upset, getting angry, then because you already given me that self, and I don't fit into the self like you want me to, and therefore you get upset with me. And similarly, if I give myself all this identity, I think myself as a very nice Buddhist, then when I start to behave or do things which is against the teachings, then I tell myself, I get very upset myself too. And more still, I'm worried that people will look at me and say, how can you behave in a non-Buddhist way? Then I try to camouflage, I try to pretend. That is another trouble. So when we talk about people, if we can stick only to the identity, if you're right, but then you start to give that self to that person, then we have got problem. If I look at you and say, okay, you know, you're a student and all these things, okay. But when I start to imagine that you should be like what I'm thinking you are, then I have problem. Because if you don't behave the way which I want you to behave, then I'm going to find fault with you. And you find that this sort of conflict creates bigger and bigger conflict. And all the things in the world is all nothing more than that clash of egos, right? Your ego and my ego. When our egos agree, we are all right. When the egos clash, you're going to get some problem. That's how people quarrel. That's how people find faults, and that's how wars start. It's not only the ego, but also the collective ego of one group of people against another group of people. You look at how religious war starts. It's because I think my religion, my religion is better than yours. Or in the same religion, my teaching is better than yours. That is the start of the conflict. And then from there, it start to create more and more difference. So it is just that self. Now, I would not be able to explain to you what the lack of self is. It's according to our teachings, the only time you can really feel the lack of self is when you do mindfulness meditation. If you don't do mindfulness meditation, we are always full of this idea about self. Right? It's just like your mind is like a box. It's always full of things. Right? And when people try to explain to you that there's nothing in this mind of yours except all the things you want to put in, we always are quite doubtful about it. So it's just like trying to explain to you how we build this self up. Now, I said before, it's from the day you're born, we start to build self up. Now that yourself is, you're full of this self, It's about time that we start to do something about it when you get into Buddhism. The reason why we do something about it is we know that the Buddha has taught us that when you create the self through our own perception and through our own beliefs, then we are going to get some problems. That suffering, that dukkha we are going to get. So we got to start to dismantle these sort of things. And how do you dismantle? That's why I said it's only through your mindfulness meditation. When you are mindful, you can see that we are nothing but a process. One thing comes after another. In we have got this other teachings called the dependent origination. Have you done the dependent origination here?
Last semester,
okay. It's from A that B happens. From B, A plus B, C happens. A plus B plus C, D happens. And the whole life is just like that. You, for example, like now, if you eat something and then you get fresh air, you get healthier. So it's just, life is just like that. And one thing will follow another. And all our actions is because of that. From what you see, something which you see, something which you smell, something which you taste, something which you hear, then it brings out what the next step. The next step is you get a sensation, and from the sensation, you get this volition, right, wanting to do something, action and reaction. And when we start to have these actions, it's the rising of the self, the rising of the ego. When you start to cling or grasp on something, that is the beginning of ego. Right? Because I, my opinion, what I think about it, and so on. Right? So, when you do your mindfulness meditation, you will be aware of it, that all these things are coming up. Right? And as it comes up, you do nothing to it, let it go. Right? So in Buddhism, our letting go is very, very important. When we do our little let goes, we are actually letting go of that self of ours. Otherwise, the self gets bigger and bigger. Right? Otherwise, the big ego gets bigger and bigger. Right? So, we got to be able to look into it. Now, the other way to look at it is, how do you identify the self? The self itself causes your ego, causes all your emotions. Right? When you get upset, who gets upset? Is it your finger that upset? Is it your thumb get upset? Is it your foot that get upset? Is it your ears that get upset? Where is it? So I won't supply you with the answer, but you find out for yourself. Is it your brain that got upset? Is your heart that got upset? But if you tell yourself, I don't want to get upset, don't want to get affected by it, when I hear something which is not pleasant to me, I just let go of it, then you won't be upset. So when you start to have the feeling that, is it my toe that got upset, my finger that get upset when you're upset, then you are starting to look into the lack of self. Which get upset? If you really get upset, it's the self that get upset. And where is the self? Is it up here? Is it here? Is it here? You won't know. The reason why you get upset is because you are in the middle of a process of getting upset. And so when we are clear in our things, we know our emotions, we know the things which causes all this suffering, get rid of that. You get rid by not being attached to thing, learning how to let go. So in mindfulness meditation, we are able to see things moving and we don't want to get attached to it, don't cling onto it. Because when you cling onto it, that ego will arise, I, my and mine. And anything which is against I, my and mine, is no good. And when it's no good, you try to react, and the reaction usually, before you can win, you already suffer. Right. So, okay, any questions about that? Now, When you talk about lack of essence, it's just like a bicycle. In the olden days, they used a chariot. How do they make bicycles? Out of nothing, right? Then some, when you make a bicycle, how do you do? There should be a handlebar, there should be a, you know what you call that, whatever, and then the wheels, and then the pedal, and then the chain and everything, right? And then nice bicycle, they get the gears on. Without all these things, is it a bicycle or not? And that's how we build up this self, from components, one after another. You look at a car, there should be a body, there should be a chassis, there should be five wheels. What are the five wheels?
Four wheels
plus
the steering wheel.
Four wheels.
Plus a steering wheel.
Steering wheel, right? There should be five wheels. Right? So when you have this all these things, you put in one by one. Right? You look at the car manufacturer, what do they do? They get the chassis first. Then they put on the axles, then they put on the cars and all this. Then they put on all, fix the doors, fix the bonnets and everything. And when do you call that a car? So this is the way we look at the self, the same thing. What do you call yourself? We start from all these component parts. According to the Buddha, the most important part in the self would be the five aggregates. From your body, or the material thing, your mental thing. The mental thing is our sensation, perception, volition, and consciousness. Right? These are the five things, which we call the five aggregates, which start to bring about this, what we call self. But if you can see that there are only five aggregates and do not cling to them, then we are getting rid of the self. So in other words, if you want to get rid of your car, you just dismantle it. Slowly take away the wheels, take away the steering wheel, the chassis, and the bonnets and the doors, everything. You got no cars left. So this is the way we dismantle ourselves. Understand, the Buddha says, perceiving a thing as a thing. When you see a thing, just know that that is just a thing. And he said, perceiving form as form, perceiving sound as sound. Now, normally we do not. When you see this, right, the eyes get in contact with this. What happened? Or the eyes get to this. What happened? Straight away you think it's a machine of some sort, isn't it? And then from there we get ideas. For me, the first time I saw these sort of things, I said, what's that? Is it a radio or not? So that's how the mind starts to work. We start to identify the whole thing. And after identifying, then we say, okay, what does this thing do? Right? Who owns this? All sorts of things will come into it. Same thing with the book. Do we say it's just a book? From that book, it's Jim's book. He's wrote a lot of things in it. Must be a magic book, because every time he comes, he brings this book around and talk on it. Right? All these things. Look at that. That thing. The Buddha image. How many ideas do you get? The moon is set eyes on it. What is it? Do you ever see that as a piece of artwork or not? Or you see that as a sculpture or not? Do you see that as a piece of thing or not? For us Buddhists, we always look that, and you see a Buddha image, what is the first thing you think of doing? Put your hands together and do that, isn't it? Because to us, that is a holy thing. We form ideas. Now, it's alright when you see that, and then you do all these things, and then you give all the self to that particular, give the essence to the particular thing. But when somebody comes and destroys it, what happens? And you get somebody who is against all this. You know? There's a lot of people in this world who are against all what they call idols. Right? They want to smash idols. Well, not only the Muslims do that. I know a lot of these fundamentalist Christians will do that. Right? So they are more powerful than you. They just come in there and they use a hammer to smash it. Then what happens to us? Do you think that it's just a piece of thing and then they just destroy it? Or do we still, they've got no respect for Buddhism and all this thing? You see how much you put that your value on that? That represents Buddhism. But in reality, what is that? If it's made of plastic, it's made of plastic. The reason why we bow to it is because we are Buddhists. We do bow to images. But when somebody destroys it, because we consider it to be holy, therefore we get upset with it. So that's how you see, when you put that essence into a thing, and then when the thing is being damaged, we get the suffering. Now, years ago, you know, remember the Taliban in Afghanistan? You know, those very powerful fellas. And in Bamiyan, there's this big, huge sitting Buddha image. It's been there for nearly 2,000 years. It's the one of the earliest thing to be erected by the Buddhists up in that area. And when the Taliban came, they are against images of any sort. So what they did, they put a dynamite there, and the next day nothing left. all the pieces of stones. And then one person of a different religion came and asked me, he says, "Jim, look what they did to your Buddha in the thing." I said, "They didn't do anything to the Buddha. Buddha is no longer around, isn't it?" They said, "But that's your religious image." I said, "It was a religious image. But now nobody in that area believe in Buddha anymore. So to them, there's a wasting. It's historical." I said, "We are putting ideas into it." I said, "How do you feel?" I said, "It's just the same as yesterday." I said, "Same the day as before, the day before yesterday." You see through it. But if we don't see through it, we get so attached to it, then what I'm going to do? I'm going to organize all my Buddhists there to go to Afghanistan and fight those Talibans because they destroyed the stone Buddha. So how many wars we fought because of this idea about things? After all, what they destroyed is a piece of stone. But because we consider the piece of stone as the identity, and we are so obsessed with this identity, therefore we get so upset, and if we are powerful enough, we're going to create a lot of problems with other people. And you look at it, all the holy wars in this world, all those people who try to do propaganda on their religion, they go and destroy other people's thinking. All because they got these ideas of self. That mine is better than yours. If you touch mine, you are insulting me. So we all, as Buddhists, we look at things in a very different way. If people bomb the thing, okay, that's it, finish. No more. So, when we have got this sort of understanding, then our suffering is less. Now, when you look at this self also, we pile a lot of importance on this person. And it's very difficult when this person whom we call you, or I call me, gets sick. When you get sick, what happens? It's because this person is not feeling well. I am not feeling well. Therefore, I'm unhappy. Now, worse still is, I have got a terrible sickness. I may die tomorrow. I'm unhappier still. But why is it so? Because we place that essence as very strongly as me. But if we can see that we are just another living being, and the Buddha knows that all living being in this world must die. All living being in this world must fall sick. Then if you start to see through that, then when you fall sick, it won't be so bad, won't it? And when you come to the state where the the doctor tells you you got final stage of cancer, you're going to die, then you can, you're not happy that you die, but you're not so unhappy. You know that it's inevitable. And that's why in Buddhism, when our people are sick, when somebody is suffering of sickness, something old and so on, and especially the sickness is terminal, when you invite a monk to come over, that's what the monk will talk to you. Ajahn Chah, who is a very great teacher, Thai monks, they taught that he's to a lot of Buddhists, he is supposed to be enlightened, right? And there's one Dharma talk he gave to an old lady. Right? This old lady is sick, and then she's dying, very old. And then they give him a dana, and usually when people in the Thai custom, when people are very sick, they always invite a monk over and give the monk food and then give a dana and listen to Dharma talk. And Ajahn Chah gave a Dharma talk to this effect. He tells the old lady, look, you're old already. Right? You are like your furniture in your house. You are like the plate. Used, it's cracked, it's old. Right? Why don't you give up and go? And how powerful the teaching is. He's trying to teach the old lady, get rid of yourself. Right? Think of yourself. What is it? Your body. In some of our form of meditation, we do meditate on the body. Right, look at the body. And then it's not that we hate the body, but understand that this body is growing, is impermanent. So he told this old lady that you are like the furniture. You're past your use-by date. You're no longer useful. If you cling on to it, you're clinging on to useless things. And why don't you go? So to us, that's the way we look at the self. When it's useful, it can be useful. But still don't cling on to it. But when it's no longer useful, let go and go. So sometimes we think of this as, very pessimistic way of looking. But is it pessimistic or is it realistic? Sometimes a lot of things which are realistic, we consider it to be pessimistic. In Buddhism, they teach us how to be real. Understand it. When you cling to useless rubbish, you're spending your time, your effort in a useless way. When this body is of no use anymore, try to give up and go. So this is the way, you look at it. I can't explain to you what no self is, but this is the way to lead us to think about what the self is. Are we making use of these ideas in a very satisfactory way? We never do. But the Buddha taught us how to see, just understand it, understand how the thing arises. And how the thing arises, how this self arises, how this self causes a lot of karma and all these things, is being taught in the dependent origination. So next time when somebody talks about dependent origination, come and listen to it. Okay, any questions? I told you it's a very difficult thing. And that's why a lot of Buddhist speakers try not to talk on anatta, because we might end up confusing people more than we explain things.
I do have a question. So, say you theoretically get the concept, but day-to-day living, how would you try and practically understand?
Yes. You got to have you got to reconcile things sometimes. You see, we cannot deny that we live in a materialistic world. Okay? No matter what it is, you got, in certain aspects, you got to have this self. You got to project this self. Now, supposing you are managing a store or managing a company, you have got to have this self, right? But when you are not managing the store, when you go home, are you going to carry this burden back to your home or not? So we behave like a manager when we are in our work. But when you are playing tennis, don't try to behave like a manager. So this is the way it is. When, for example, when we are organizing things, we can be a leader. But don't expect to be the leader everywhere. When you are no longer organizing things, when you are with another organization, where you are just one of the other fellas, just be the other fella. So that means you do not have that essence of that leadership. So it's not easy to do that sometimes because of our ego. I told you the ego is a terrible thing. Because I'm a successful person, how can I go there and do this sort of things? I am managing 40 or 50 employees. Do you think I want to clean the toilet or not? Why don't you want to clean the toilet? Because of the ego, isn't it? So we got to change according to our situation. And hello? And it's not easy to do that. So that's why I told you all, just be aware, be mindful of that mindset. I've done, sometimes you work in charities, you find that the people who come and volunteer to work, there are different kinds of people. That's my experience, right? And some are bank managers, some are whatever, you know? And I noticed there's one particular case. Everybody comes here, they want to do important work, right? in a charity, isn't it? After all, I'm a graduate, I'm this and that, you know? So they want to do all the important job. And one day, this old lady came and see me. He said, "Jim, where is your mop and where is your bucket?" I said, "What do you want mop and bucket for?" "So that I can clean the toilet." So I found out later that this old lady is the mother of a very rich man. And I know that this particular old lady is so successful in putting her ego down. That means at the time when she washed the toilet, there's no ego. So same thing with us, you know, I'm telling you, in society, when we are in certain things, we got to get dressed up and so on. But if you are going to go and do this, if you are going to volunteer in the temple and sweep the floor, don't go in your coat and tie then. So it's that sort of thing. And not only in the external thing, but inside here, the attitude. When we are used to giving instructions, we got to know that there are times when we have got to accept instructions. So in other words, you see, one is the leader self, one is the follower self. You swap over. Don't simply have this self and say, "I won't be able to change." Did I answer your question? Yes. So we are not saying like the Buddha has got a self, though. Not a self like we think. There's a place, Buddha has got an identity. Right? And during his time, people worship him. Right? They go there, they respect him fully and all these things. He knows that, but he doesn't allow that to get into his head. That you can see in his lifestyle. Is the Buddha full of ego or not? I can tell you no. Although he says Tathagata and all this, but when it comes to bringing up his bowl to go to household, he still takes his bowl and walk to householders to get his food. In other words, to put in a very crude way, he still begs for his food. And that big teacher begging for food. He could have said that now, bring him the best food in the country. But no, he goes from house to house. And whatever people give, he has got to eat. In other words, he's got no more ego. He can be seen from that. And in the story, in his story about the last few months of his life, he's already 80 years old. He wants to travel around, you know, to go and see his people, his little communities. He could have asked the king, hey, give me your chariot. Could have ridden on the chariot. But no. He walked around and very far from one community to another. Sometimes you got to walk for one whole day. 80 years old and still walking around. Is there ego or not? He could have asked, the king could have given, all the kings there could have given anything he wants. But no. He follows his rules. Right? So you can see that sort of things. And that, our head teacher, as we call the Buddha, is our example. But see how he lives. Any other questions? All right.
No other questions?
Okay, remember I, my, and mine. How much problem it causes you. I, my things, my looks, my behavior, how much problem it causes people. Everything to do with I, my, and mine. But it doesn't mean that you've got to give away everything. Just to answer your question. There are some times when we have got to make use of this. Because otherwise, you have got to live in a, become a holy person, live in a temple. But even in a temple, there's still I and mine, if you are not careful. Okay.